Among the people rushing to flee Afghanistan are journalists, but some want to return to bear witness.
If journalists leave a scene, it becomes a black hole. Then the world doesn't find out what's happening. And when the world doesn't know what's happening, human sympathy also evaporates.
Also today, the next UN climate summit is coming up soon. African nations are pushing for their due, the necessary resources to adapt to a warming world.
There is a lot of money in this world. It's only that there is no political will by those who have caused the climate problem.
I'm Marco Werman, and COVID cases surge in Japan as Tokyo prepares for another massive sporting event, the Paralympics. And speaking of sports, the Pope gets a present. We'll tell you what it is. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Protesters took to the streets in Afghanistan for the second straight day to rally against Taliban rule. Today, protests reached the capital, Kabul. As many as 200 people gathered before armed Taliban fighters violently dispersed the crowd. In the eastern city of Assadabad, several people were killed in protests today, either by stampedes or gunfire. The Taliban fired on people waving the Afghan flag to mark the nation's annual Independence Day. The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is now the official name of the country. Meanwhile, the evacuation of Afghans continued at an accelerated pace today. Nations like Spain, Germany, and Australia flew out their citizens, along with scores of Afghans. U.S. officials say they are processing about 500 people each hour at the airport. Outside the airport, more violence and chaos. The Taliban continued to patrol the roads leading to the terminal, blocking entrances and beating back crowds. In this video, obtained by the New York Times, soldiers fire guns in the air. Then one soldier appears to shoot into the crowd. Inside the airport, the U.S. military remains in control. Ayesha Tanzim, the Afghanistan-Pakistan bureau chief for Voice of America, the U.S. government-owned broadcaster, is there today. I caught up with her at the airport, where she was waiting for a flight out.
The evacuation flights are going very, very quickly. Hundreds, if not more, are being processed and put onto those flights. But the stories I got today, some of them were heart-wrenching because these people who are about to get on these flights, some of them were separated from their family members. So I met this young teenager. He had no idea where the rest of his family was, and he didn't have a phone. And he said that they didn't have a phone. I met some other people who said that half of their family was left outside and the other half was inside. The scene outside the airport is a lot more chaotic. And I have gone through that while I was trying to get inside the airport. There are thousands of people, many of whom are literally camping outside the airport. They're not going home. They're spending their nights there without their luggage, without anything, because there is no hope of getting anything in the rush and the pushing and the shoving that you have to go through to get inside the airport. All gates of the airport are surrounded by people who want to get in. You hear constant gunfire, and I saw it with my own eyes, mostly Taliban firing into the air as a method of crowd control. And I also met people who managed to get inside without complete documents, and once inside, they were told, you cannot go anywhere from here because you don't have a passport.
Can you tell us about one family you met there?
One family that I met, they thought they were going to be sent back outside and they were afraid that the Taliban were going to come for them. It was the family of a man who had served with the U.S. military as security. And he came in with his badge, him and his family. He was allowed onto the airport. But once there, since none of them had any passports, they could not go any further. And his family was sitting inside the airport on the floor saying, we're afraid we're going to be sent outside and the Taliban will find us. And if they find out about us, they will kill us.
I mean, the stories of Afghans trying to leave are so heartbreaking. That's just one of many. So what were you seeing around the city? Like, what's the state of the city, the physical nature of the city before you headed to the airport?
We saw hardly any women, maybe three or four women, fully covered in abayas with hijab. That is not usually how women in Kabul walk around. They do have a headscarf and long tunics and jeans, but, you know, that day, the three or four women on the street were fully covered. Even the men had changed their clothing. Gone were any t-shirts and jeans, which is very normal in Kabul. Everybody was in local dress, the shalwar kameez. So everybody had taken it upon themselves to be extra cautious. It was very obvious. And then when I left for the airport, and I had to make three runs for the airport on multiple days, unsuccessful ones, of course.
Were you stopped each time? Is that what happened?
I wasn't stopped by the Taliban. The first two times when I got close to the airport, there were thousands of people there, all trying to get inside. And by the time we got close, we saw Taliban with long batons trying to do crowd control, pushing people back from the airport, sometimes firing into the air to keep the crowds away from the airport. Otherwise, the thousands were just about to, like, literally become a mob and try to get inside. There was no way. All the doors were locked. The security inside, they had locked all the gates. They were not willing to open any doors, so there was no way to get inside. And because there were bullets being fired in the air, I turned around on my first attempt and my second attempt. The third time around, I found out that a new gate behind the airport was going to be open for, you know, the U.S. nationals, Canadians, Europeans, and SIV, the special immigrant visa applicants. When we got in, there was no line. We were just pushed and shoved around for 2 hours in the crowd. I saw women wailing. I saw people getting panic attacks. I was afraid that some of those children who were perched on top of their father's shoulders or their uncle's shoulders were going to fall down. I saw, you know, women almost about to fall down because it was sunny, it was hot, and they were sweating, their hair was wet. It was not a good scene. And like I said, it took 2 hours of pushing and shoving till I got close to the turnstile and showed my U.S. passport and finally got in. But people outside were desperate.
Just flabbergasting. I'm speaking with Ayesha Tanzim, the Afghanistan-Pakistan Bureau Chief for Voice of America. The Taliban spokesmen, and they are all men, they say they'll be more accommodating toward journalists than they were in their previous era in power in the 90s. What do you think?
We have to wait and see. In the first few days, they have been more accommodating to journalists. So on day one and day two, they did not stop journalists. But day three, they stopped some journalists and interrogated them, asked who they were and whose permission they had and all of that. They told local journalists to register with their media commission. At the same time, I talked to the head of news of one of Afghanistan's biggest TV channels, and they said that their teams, including women, were going out to report. And sometimes they were stopped by Taliban, sometimes they were not stopped by Taliban, but so far they were not stopped from reporting. Their channel was on air. However, a lot of people, including local journalists, said that they thought that this was temporary, that the Taliban were now busy with other things. They were busy because they were negotiating with local Afghan leaders. They were going around the city, disarming security guards and whatever police and security forces they could find. So they were busy in other things. That's why they were allowing the media to work and the women to go out. But a lot of local journalists thought that once Taliban solidified their hold on power, things would change. These are still early days, and we have to wait and watch and see once the Taliban settle in and they actually are in the government. They have not announced their government yet. They continue to repeat that they want to form an inclusive government. They have not yet announced what form that government would take, whether the leader of the inclusive government would be a president or a khalifa or a prime minister, nobody knows. But because they have a history, 40 years of war, the 90s era that people still remember, they've heard stories from their parents. I talked to people who remembered. One person said his mother told him how she was beaten by the Taliban for not wearing the abaya the right way. So people have those stories in their minds.
Ayesha, on top of what journalists generally are facing, we have to talk about what it's like being a woman and a journalist. What has that been like these past few days for you?
Well, I did what all the other Afghan female journalists did and all the international female journalists did, which is I changed my dress. So I used to go out in Kabul with jeans, a long tunic, and a headscarf. But as soon as the Taliban entered the city, I started wearing a long abaya, started covering my entire head, you know, and the people that I tried to talk to over the phone, the political analysts, the activists that we used to routinely talk to said, we are not doing media these days. We are not talking to anyone these days. So I also became cautious, not because the Taliban told me, but because I don't know what the Taliban red line is. And because every one of them is carrying an AK-47, I don't want to annoy a Talib on the streets who could get offended by my dress code. So the Taliban have told people that they want to implement Sharia law. They haven't really told people what does that mean.
Right.
A lot of women are asking them on Twitter, what do you mean by Sharia law? Does that mean I can go to work? Does that mean I can walk around the streets without a male accompanying me? Does that mean that, you know, I can choose whatever profession I want to choose? Because Afghan women over the last 20 years have become, you know, artists and filmmakers and actors and singers, along with doctors and teachers and journalists and anchors and field reporters. They're working in offices. They're in government. You know, at one time, the mayor of Kabul was a woman. So there is no clear answer yet. Taliban have been very vague with it.
Even though you're at the airport now, are you still dressing more conservatively?
No. At the airport, it's very safe. The perimeter is now secured by international forces. The U.S. is in negotiation with the Taliban to make sure the evacuation is safe. So far, the Taliban seem to be sticking to whatever negotiation they had with the U.S.,
Yeah, for you, 3 days in the waiting area at Kabul International Airport, in the eyes of many Afghans, you'll be seen as a lucky one. When do you think you'll be able to fly out, though?
I'm hoping to catch a flight out tomorrow. That would be Friday. Let's see.
Can you imagine returning to Kabul in the near future?
I hope so. I mean, if the situation stabilizes and I feel like as a journalist, I can continue to work here without being harmed, I would like to return and report on the story. This is history in the making. This is a big story. But more importantly, I feel like if journalists leave a scene, it becomes a black hole. Then the world doesn't find out what's happening. And when the world doesn't know what's happening, human sympathy also evaporates. That's why conflict reporting is so important, because it is only when the world can see the misery of people that there's pressure on governments and the international community to do something about it.
That is a great point. Ayesha Tanzim, the Afghanistan-Pakistan Bureau Chief for Voice of America, the U.S. government-owned broadcaster. She's been speaking with us from Kabul. Ayesha, thank you very much. Stay safe.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more Afghanistan coverage later in the show, including a look at high-tech biometric devices captured by the Taliban.
You could use the data and the devices to systematically find individuals who worked with the U.S. as an interpreter.
How facial recognition software is creating even more worries for people trying to evade the Taliban. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. In just over 2 months, negotiators from around the world will gather in Glasgow, Scotland for the next big UN climate summit, a crucial meeting for bringing climate change under control. Today on The Big Fix, we're looking at what nations in Africa will be pushing for.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
If you look at a pie chart of which countries emit the most carbon emissions, China and the U.S. have the biggest slices. The entire continent of Africa takes up just a tiny sliver of that chart. And yet, Africans are experiencing some of the worst impacts of climate change. At the upcoming climate summit, negotiators for the African bloc will be pushing hard for money to help deal with those impacts and funds to switch to cleaner energy to help combat climate change. Reporter Ridwan Karimdini Osman has our story from Ghana.
At the heart of the savanna region in northern Ghana is the small village of Pinchila. It is home to more than 2,000 people, mostly farmers. I meet Isapate sitting on the ground in front of his thatched roof house. He has been farming for the past 30 years. This year, he says his harvest was only half as large as it usually is.
I don't know.
The weather is constantly changing. We can no longer predict the rains. We don't even know when to plant our seedlings. Last year, two of my children had to drop out of school because I couldn't get enough money from the harvest.
Scientists say climate change is altering rain patterns around the world, making both droughts and unusually heavy rains more frequent. Pate is thinking about quitting farming, even though he has no other way to support his wife and 8 children.
For the most part of 2020, my family went hungry because the rains kept delaying. Currently, even where to find water for irrigation is another headache. All the dams have dried up because of the hot weather.
Zainabu Nindopate echoes her husband's frustration.
The entire house used to be filled with bags of maize, yam and granite. But now we are struggling. I can't even go to the market anymore. What am I going to sell?
Experts say vulnerable communities like Pinchila need to adapt and prepare for worsening climate change. But the Ghanaian government says it doesn't have the money to pay for things like new irrigation projects or drought-resistant seed, especially with rising debt due to the COVID-19 pandemic. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on the international community to help.
As the continent that has contributed least to the climate crisis, Africa deserves the strongest possible support and solidarity. I ask that by COP26, we have concrete proposals on the table to make access to climate finance easier and faster, including for African nations.
The developed world is already falling short on promises to mobilize $100 billion a year to help developing nations adapt to and limit climate change. But developing countries say even that amount isn't enough. At this year's climate conference, the Africa negotiating team will be pushing for $20 to $30 billion earmarked specifically for African nations. Negotiator Saini Nafu believes that could be easily met by developed countries.
We have become extremely shrewd in building coalitions with the rest of our developing countries groups to really advocate for our demands.
Nafu tells me some of the money they are asking for will be used to bring relief to farmers bearing the brunt of climate change.
Net shading, drip irrigation, digital climate advisory services, all of that needs to be brought to our farmers. And mobilizing climate finance, this is what we have realized as a group, is a full-time job.
By 2050, the UN estimates annual adaptation costs in developing countries could increase sevenfold. The Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance argues it is time leaders acted with the same urgency in addressing climate change as they did dealing with the pandemic. Mithika Mwenda is the alliance's executive director.
If industrialized countries were able to mobilize trillions and trillions of dollars to address this COVID-19 crisis, it means there is a lot of money in this world. It's only that there is no political will.
Experts worry that richer countries may use the pandemic as an excuse for not meeting or increasing funding for developing nations. Aberdeen University energy economist Theo Echampong argues African negotiators should point out that COVID has hit their economies even harder.
African nations need to spin the narrative actually around COVID and say that the pandemic has actually made things quite difficult for a number of our economies. Most of the funding that pre-COVID would have come in had been curtailed, and this has had a dire impact on many livelihoods.
Young people will be most impacted by climate change, and African youth delegations will be attending the conference to push for more inclusion in the UN process. Cordy Aziz from Ghana will be among them.
It's very important that the African youth participate and really understand what's happening so that we can better address issues that are happening in our own communities.
Back in northern Ghana, farmers like Issa Pate look forward to the days when the government helps pay for irrigation technologies, flood defense structures, and drought-resistant agriculture.
We seriously need this infrastructure here, especially for our vegetable farms. They will make life better.
Until then, Pate has planted again and is hoping for more predictable rains and a better harvest this season. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in northern Ghana.
This story was supported by funding from the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. Pope Francis, he is known as a man of the people. When he works the crowds, the faithful want to touch him, shake his hand, or give him a memento like a teddy bear. This week, though, the Pope got a gift that for him is much more to his liking. If you know, you know. That's the unmistakable sound of a foosball table. The game I spent countless hours playing in college. A Tuscany-based foosball association, Sport Toscana Calcio Balilla in Alto Pascio, presented the gift to the Argentine-born Pope, who is a well-known lover of football, a.k.a. soccer in America. For foosball, of course, no cleats needed. Pope Francis played around with the president of the association. The pontiff took red, and I'm just contemplating what you do in this situation. Do you just let the Pope win, or, you know, go for it? Honestly, I think the Pope would want me to show up with my best game. Would you be brave enough to take on Pope Francis in a pickup game of foosball? How does it feel to say, Holy See, game on? We have pictures on our Twitter. We're at The World. The Afghan national women's soccer team was formed 14 years ago. A female team sent a strong message to the Taliban.
We will stand and we will fight against you. Our fight is through football. Our activism is through football. And we have called the Taliban as our enemy.
Now those same women are in hiding. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Olympic athletes may have left Tokyo, but the athletes' village is back in use, filling up with 4,000 Paralympians. The Paralympic Games start on Tuesday, 2 more weeks of sport, and 2 weeks of COVID challenges. The World's Bianca Hillier has been covering all the games for us. Hey, Bianca.
Hi, Marco.
So as the Olympics were wrapping up, we were seeing record-high COVID case counts in Tokyo and surrounding areas there. How has the situation been since then?
Those numbers are still climbing. Tokyo and the surrounding regions are being hit by the Delta variant, you know, just like so many other places around the world. And now 60% of the population will be under a state of emergency until September 12th. So that's right through the Paralympics. And experts say the Olympics did indirectly lead to a rise in cases. So now there's a worry the same will happen during the Paralympics. I spoke with Dr. Kentaro Iwata, an infectious diseases expert at Kobe University, who told me how the games can sort of interfere with important COVID messaging.
If you are in a state of emergency, then you keep saying that you have to stay home, you have to take this safety precaution, so on and so on. But these efforts were not seen on television, radio, by anybody, because you turn on TV, then you watch the smiling Olympic athletes just holding the gold medals.
The thing is, the International Olympic Committee and Japanese government adamantly deny any connection between the games and infections. And Dr. Iwata told me their denial is irresponsible.
If they deny it, they are either not scientific or simply a liar. And I know that I'm using the strong word, but this is true.
Wow. Bianca, are there lessons the Paralympic Committee has learned from the Olympics earlier this month?
Yeah, there are. I got on the phone with Stuart Willick. He's the medical director for the International Paralympic Committee for this summer's games. And he said watching the Olympics earlier this month was proof that the Paralympics can go on safely.
The Paralympic movement often considers the Olympics a big test event, and we allow the organizing committee and the IOC to smooth everything out for us.
Willick also told me that the discussion of whether or not to hold the Paralympics is at this stage a, quote, moot point, especially since the IPC estimates almost 90% of the delegations are vaccinated, which is slightly higher than the estimate for the Olympic delegations.
Right, but now there's a state of emergency through September 12th. What about some athletes at the Paralympics facing a higher risk during the pandemic? I gather experts are warning that some Paralympians may be more vulnerable to COVID-19. Tell me more about that, Bianca.
Yeah, those concerns are coming up. And in a statement last year, the IPC itself said that some athletes could be more vulnerable. Stuart Willick, again from the IPC, recognizes this in some cases. Here he is.
If somebody has a very high-level spinal cord injury and lives in a care center, they can have increased risk of getting COVID because they live in a care center, and increased risk of more severe disease because they have impaired pulmonary function. So it all depends on the situation.
Willick says the majority of Paralympians are not at a higher risk for COVID. Still, there are some added systems in place to keep Paralympians safe. For instance, if someone has a visual impairment, there will be audio messages, and there are stations in the village if someone needs help swabbing for their daily COVID test.
Bianca, that makes me wonder about guides and personal care assistants who accompany Paralympic teams. I know organizers are trying to keep a low attendance at the Games, but has this impacted staffing numbers?
So guides and personal care assistants are definitely allowed at the Paralympics, but there are some reports from athletes saying they've been denied their request to bring a personal care assistant because of COVID-19 restrictions on team sizes. And Paralympic gold medalist Becca Myers, who swims for Team USA, says this happened to her, and she's actually chosen to withdraw from the Games because she says she wouldn't have the support she needs there. And her decision got a lot of attention and even prompted Senator Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire to call out the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee at a Senate hearing.
This is an outrage and a preventable situation that should never have gotten to this point. I want the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee to work immediately to address this issue, and I want them to ensure that all of our athletes are able to compete safely at this summer's game.
I reached out to the Olympic Committee to learn how these staffing decisions are made and allocated, but they didn't reply to my request for comment.
The World's Bianca Hillier has been covering the Olympics and Paralympics for us. The opening ceremony for the Paralympic Games is set for Tuesday of next week. Bianca, thanks so much. Really appreciate this.
Thanks, Marco.
A tech scandal is unfolding in Germany. It involves the ruling political party and a young IT security researcher. At stake, criminal consequences. The defense, the IT worker in question, says she was only trying to do the right thing after finding a massive security flaw. Jenny Russell reports from Berlin.
It took 25-year-old Lilith Wittmann only a few hours in May to crack open the app of Germany's ruling party, the CDU.
They just didn't have any kind of serious security measures.
In a Berlin park, Wittmann reflects on one of the biggest discoveries of her career, and then all of the fallout. Party campaigners were using CDU Connect to gauge public opinion in the run-up to September's federal election.
It was a bit like, wow, they are collecting like super personal data about people, so where they are living and what is their political opinion.
Wittmann downloaded CDU Connect and quickly realized the app didn't use common security practices and that she could easily access the personal information, including birth dates and addresses, of nearly 20,000 party members. But that wasn't all.
More than 500,000 data points from people where they are living, plus their political opinion, plus if they are interested in CDU.
In the app, campaigners had recorded the locations of people they doorknocked, sometimes even house addresses and names.
Quite a few times, they added like information who this actually is and even what they talked about at this specific point in time.
Wittmann reported her findings to German technology authorities and the CDU and blogged about it. The party publicly admitted she had found a flaw and yanked the app offline. Next, Wittmann says she got a phone call from a senior CDU official, offering a half-hearted thank you, a job offer she turned down, and then a warning the party might file a criminal complaint against her. It's a threat the CDU followed through on. A few weeks ago, an email from Berlin police.
It said actually that I'm a suspect in this investigation about the CDU Connect app, and yeah, that they want to know my address.
The German law doesn't really differentiate between so-called ethical hacking and hacking that is with a bad intention.
David Albrecht's Berlin law firm represents both hackers and organizations that have been hacked. He says Wittmann's case highlights a controversial change to Germany's criminal code. Before 2007, hackers had to obtain secure data to have committed a crime. Then a CDU-led parliament tightened the law to crack down on rising cybercrime and to comply with new EU legislation. The amended law forbids any form of hacking, regardless of intention.
From that point on, it was sufficient that the offender only gains access to the data.
Michael Prinzinger runs a security consulting firm and co-founded one of Berlin's largest meetups of researchers and ethical hackers. He says reactions like the CDU's have become increasingly rare.
The backlash on organizations that persecuted people to report vulnerabilities was, and as we can also see in this case, is huge.
Prinzinger hopes Wittmann's experience doesn't have a chilling effect on others doing this work.
The message might be that people will feel like a criminal when they actually do the right thing and report a vulnerability.
The CDU recently apologized to Wittmann again, claiming its complaint wasn't meant to be about her hack, but another alleged data breach. The party says it has withdrawn its complaint. CDU Connect is now under investigation by Berlin's Data Protection Authority. But Wittmann says police have confirmed they're still investigating her.
It's super absurd. I really hoped that this wouldn't happen when you report something to them.
Ethical hacking has its place, Wittmann says, and German law should reflect that. She says she realized what was at stake here, even if it's politically damaging for the CDU to admit.
There's 500,000 data points about public opinions in there. So we really should take care of this data, or maybe it shouldn't even exist.
For The World, I'm Jenny Russell in Berlin.
Many Afghan Americans are in shock. They've been trying to reach family members to help them. Others have been vocal on social media. Some have organized rallies. Aisha Wahab has done all of that and more. Wahab is the first Afghan-American woman elected to public office in the U.S. She joins us now from Hayward, California, where she serves as the mayor pro tem. Ms. Wahab, what has this past week or so been like for you?
Exhausting. It has been traumatizing for a lot of our elders who have actually lived through it. I'm fortunate to be American-born. At the same time, even American-born young Afghans feel traumatized. You see time and time again, women, children, minorities, ethnic and religious, activists, artists, they are all extremely scared and extremely vulnerable to what's going to happen in the future. Many of them are afraid of being identified. One of the concerns is that while the Taliban took the different cities and also the government buildings, they have access to the paperwork and identification. If they're looking somebody up, if they're trying to find something, they do have records now. So they are deeply, deeply concerned and a lot of fear of the unknown.
As for the documents you were talking about, Ms. Wahab, on social media, you've been promoting a tool called Backpack. It's a place where folks in Afghanistan can upload important documents. Tell us about this and why it's important.
We've heard so many different accounts of young people, artists and journalists destroying their identification, destroying diplomas, destroying things like that. So this is an app. It's completely free. UC Davis is actually behind the app. The core concept is to secure their credentials and academic documents and be able to destroy their actual living document and have something secure in the cloud. Hence the concept of the universal tool for academic mobility called Backpack. You want to protect yourself from the Taliban and potential reprisals, if you will. But at the same time, to be able to apply for asylum, to be able to prove who you are and what you do, you need documentation. This is a tool that at least allows somebody to say, I can protect my life here and now, and potentially go through the red tape of having to prove myself via this app.
So let me turn the focus to your Afghan-American community there in Hayward, California. Earlier this week, you organized a rally in Hayward in support of the Afghan people. Tell me about the atmosphere. What was it like?
This rally, I genuinely, while organizing it, I wanted it to be positive. So I really tried to stay away from anything that did not unite the community. We specifically focused on just the national Afghan flag, the flag that has flown for decades above Afghanistan. The Afghan flag is the one symbol of unity across the nation. And every single Afghan that was at that rally agreed. We're very hopeful. When there was an individual that tried to disturb the rally, chanting, I hate to say it, but death to the Taliban, death to whoever else and whatever else, I specifically grabbed the mic and I said, no, Zindabad Afghanistan, which basically means long live Afghanistan. I said, we are not going to spread hatred here. A lot of Afghans got the message. And they were extremely hopeful. They were chanting positive things, love, peace, you name it. And everyone, a lot of the elders were crying, coming up, hugging, just expressing their sorrows and their just their feelings of heartbrokenness. And many of them said that we felt so disturbed and heartbroken over what we've seen. And I will say that I didn't think that this rally was going to really do anything for me. But I am leaving feeling invigorated to do more, to play my part of how can I help.
Aisha Wahab is the mayor pro tem of Hayward, California. Ms. Wahab, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We've heard a lot about Afghans who worked for the U.S. and are concerned that their paper documents attesting how they helped could essentially be death sentences if the Taliban find them. But the fear doesn't stop with paper documents. There are also U.S. military biometric devices. These are high-tech tools that contain sensitive data like iris scans and fingerprints, tools to distinguish friend from possible enemy. In the hands of the Taliban, they could be used to identify Afghans who worked with coalition forces. This was first reported by The Intercept. Joining me now is Welton Chang, Chief Technology Officer at Human Rights First. He's also a former intelligence officer at the Defense Intelligence Agency. Welton, how did these devices fall into the hands of the Taliban in the first place?
Our understanding is that these devices were likely originally in the hands of Afghan security forces or other Afghan officials. And during the retreat from bases and other institutions and locations, the devices were obtained by Taliban forces.
So these are handheld interagency identity detection equipment, or HIDE for short. They can access large centralized databases. What kind of information is stored on these devices?
So the system allows you to do facial recognition as well, and there's a way to collect fingerprints. You know, the iris scans, given their level of accuracy and the ease of collection, that was a preferred method. You could store some of those biometrics locally on the device itself. And then when you got back to somewhere where you had connectivity, you could hook the device to the larger database where there's a lot more records of other people inside the system.
I was going to ask you, what is the likelihood that the Taliban could just turn on these devices and access the data?
You would need some way of accessing the network where the larger databases are stored. There's still the challenge of the locally stored information, either a memory card or some kind of native storage on the device itself. So a limited number of records may be on the devices. That's concerning as well. I think one other concern looking forward is the other biometric databases that were created by the Afghan government, whether or not the Taliban have access to those. And if they are the legitimate government of Afghanistan, they would have legitimate access to things like the biometric database that was created to identify individuals during the most recent national election.
So what were these HIDE devices used by coalition forces for exactly?
They were used for a number of different purposes. One was to enroll detainees into the system so that in the future, if these individuals were involved in, say, planting an ID or some other violent act, they would be disallowed from activities such as joining the Afghan security forces and working on coalition bases. So there are certainly security aspects of the system that were legitimate. These were the best way to understand who it was you were actually talking to and quite accurate in terms of how they were measuring who was in front of them.
So how concerned are you, Welton, that these HIDE devices are now in the hands of the Taliban?
Yeah, I mean, there are a range of human rights concerns. The first is that you could use the data and the devices to systematically find individuals who were previously a part of security forces, the government, worked with the U.S. as an interpreter or as a local national worker on a base. And that systematic process could lead to many people being harmed. You could also use that data to discriminate against people moving forward about getting jobs and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of concerns if, in fact, they have access to these databases.
Welton Chang is Chief Technology Officer at Human Rights First. He's also a former intelligence officer at the Defense Intelligence Agency. Thank you very much for your explanations, Welton.
Thank you, Marco.
In Turkey, the murder of a family of seven this summer has frightened the Kurdish community there. Government officials characterize it as a dispute between two families over pasture land, but Kurdish activists say it's the latest in a string of incidents targeting Kurdish people in Turkey. From Istanbul, Duri Buscaran reports.
Deniz Dedioğlu-Lara remembers his older brother Yashar as kind and generous, the kind of guy whose door was always open for a cup of tea. He was a farmer who raised his family in the western Turkish city of Konya. It felt safer than their father's hometown, which had burnt to the ground during Turkey's war against violent Kurdish separatists in the 1990s. Whenever he spoke to his brother on the phone, Dedioğlu remembers, his brother said he liked living in Konya. He'd say, "I'm an old man. I don't have a problem with anyone. Nothing will happen to us." But 3 weeks ago, on July 30th, Dedioğlu Lara's brother Yashar, his brother's wife, and their five adult children were killed by a lone gunman in their home. Afterwards, the suspect set fire to the building. He was later apprehended by police. A video of the attack, taken from a security camera, quickly surfaced, as did a motive that showed there might be more to the story. Abdurrahman Karabulut is a lawyer who represents high-profile Kurdish political figures. He says the Dedioğlu Lara family contacted him months before they died, saying they were being threatened by a neighboring family. Speaking through a translator, Karabulut says this feud goes back a decade, when the neighbor asked Yashar Dedioğlu Lara for help in the fields. As they worked, they heard a news broadcast on the radio about an attack on Turkish soldiers by the PKK, a militant Kurdish separatist group. And the neighbor used an ethnic slur against Kurds.
After that, Mr. Yashar told them, "I am also Kurdish. Why do you say these kinds of things?"
Diyor yani sen neden bütün Kürtlere küfür ediyorsun? Kürtlerle PKK'ler bir değildir şeklinde.
That all the Kurdish people are not the supporters of PKK. Why are we saying bad things about all the Kurdish people?
The argument escalated over years. In May, just weeks before their deaths, Karabulut says a mob of 60 people descended on the Dedioğlu Lara family, beating them and leaving four injured. The Dedioğlu Laras told Karabulut that they were being targeted because they were Kurdish. After the attack, Turkish police arrested 10 members of the neighboring family and the murder suspect, who is also one of their relatives. That's why Karabulut sees this case as a clear example of a hate crime and one that could have been prevented.
Türk-Kürt meselesiyle ilgili herhangi bir tarafı söz konusu değildir.
Turkey's Interior Minister, Süleyman Soylu, commented on the massacre just a day after their deaths. He said the killing of the Dedioğlu Lara family was being politicized and exploited. "This has nothing to do with the Turkish-Kurdish issue," he said. "Bringing this into this issue is as dangerous as this attack. It is a shameful assessment." But Kurdish activists like Parliament member Hisyar Özsoy disagree.
They try to localize the issue by calling it interpersonal conflict, or maybe the person is not psychologically stable. So these are all means and discourses not to call it racial violence. This is ethnic racial violence against Kurdish people, to put it so simply.
Özsoy is a member of the HDP, Turkey's pro-Kurdish political party. Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has long accused the party of being a political front for the PKK, despite carrying about 12% of the national vote in the last parliamentary elections. Özsoy sees this rhetoric as encouraging attacks on Kurdish civilians throughout the country, particularly against seasonal workers.
In Marmaris, in Muğla, in Konya before, and in Ankara, it was kind of a series of attacks over the last 2 months. And then it somehow culminated into this horrendous massacre.
The suspect charged in the Dedio Lulara's deaths is now waiting on his day in court. In the meantime, Turkey is grappling with what this attack means for its national identity. For the world, I'm Duri Buskerin, Istanbul.
The Taliban leadership in Kabul vowed this week to respect women's rights. In the past, the extremists have barred women from working outside the home, prevented them from even leaving the house without a male guardian. For school-age girls, the classroom was not an option. Forget about sports altogether. So now, with the Taliban back in control, Afghan girls and women are watching and waiting.
They are so worried. They are afraid. They are receiving the threats from the man in the country, saying that we will not leave you, we'll come after you.
Khalida Popal is the founder and former captain of Afghanistan's first national women's soccer team. She was a high-profile advocate for the sport and for the rights of women. Then 5 years ago, a series of death threats led her to seek refuge in Denmark. She now lives in Copenhagen and has been getting a lot of phone calls recently from her former teammates back in Afghanistan.
When I talk with my girls, they cry, and what they say and that hurts me the most is that the world abandoned the women of Afghanistan.
Popal helped start the women's team in 2007. That was 6 years after the fall of the Taliban. Even then, it was a gutsy move. The Taliban may not have been in power, but they were still in the country. And a women's soccer team sent a strong message.
To say to the Taliban that we will not give up, the women of Afghanistan is unbeatable. We will stand and we will fight against you. Our fight is through football. Our activism is through football. And we have called the Taliban as our enemy. And what our players are so scared is that they see from the window of their houses their enemies outside their door.
This week, Popal has been telling her players to lay low and stay indoors.
What I'm recommending them is take down your photos, take down your social media channels, remove your names, try to hide. Please wear burqas so people don't identify if you really need to get out.
Popal is well aware of the dangers women could face in Afghanistan under Taliban rule. As I said, her activism made her a target of Taliban threats in 2016. That happened as the U.S.-backed government was said to be building a civil society with human rights for all.
We had soldiers from all over the countries. They could not provide protection for me. So now it is even worse because now all those women are vulnerable. They are in the hand of enemies.
She knows that her teammates and countless more Afghan women don't want to go backwards. They want to choose their own path in life.
They don't want to get married with all these imams and mullahs. They want to study. They want to work. They want to play football. They want to travel. What is happening is disaster, this human disaster.
Khalida Popal, one of the founders of Afghanistan's national women's soccer team. She was speaking earlier this week from her home in Copenhagen with our CBC colleagues at the program As It Happens. And that's where we sign off today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.